session number 11073, reel 2.
Mr. Parr, reel 2.
Turning right as you went down the stairs, two of the chaps went in there. I didn't bother. I just went straight into the gun pit and climbed in and looked at this thing. I'd never had any experience with one of these before. We knew it was there. We knew its caliber. We knew a lot about it. I climbed on to the seat and sat there and looked. In front of me was a telescopic sight. There was an elevating handle, a traversing handle. I tried them out. The gun swung up and down, and it was gorgeous. It traversed left and right. We've got the thing going. Chap behind me had opened the breech. Somebody was bringing up ammunition. They were very large shells, standing about that tall off the ground. I'd say just over 2 foot, maybe 2 foot six, as near as I can remember. We slammed one up the breech. Right, all we've got to do is find out our fire thing. I got off the seat. Charlie was stood next to me. Now, I worked out that if you're elevating and rotating and one thing another this side, the firing button must be on the other side. I walked round there looking for it. I climbed up onto the base of the thing and was looking around, and Charlie said, "Hang about, I found something here." I said, "What you got, Charlie?" He says, "There's a button here." I said, "Well, press it and see what happens." He did. The first shell from that gun was fired by Charlie Gardner by accident. It took off in the general direction of Con, and I turned a somersault backwards. I thought both my eardrums had gone. Charlie clambered back, turned round, and he said, "I want nothing else to do with it. It's all yours." And I spent all day on D-Day firing that gun. There was all sorts of things to fire at. There were snipers. There was all sorts of things. Mostly snipers and blokes coming up on both banks. At one stage, and on more than one occasion, I fell out with Major John Howard. He was trying to communicate, as he had to, the poor chap, backwards and forwards, with brigade and God knows what. And he was over there in that concrete pillbox that he'd made his HQ. Very sensible man, incidentally. With Ted Hammond Jan Tappen and his radio man. And every now and then he'd come out and say, "Pa! Get the bloody gun quiet! I can't hear a bloody word on it! Say, shut it up!" "All right." So what, you know, so on and so on. But then he'd gallivant up to Benneville or across the bridge, and of course we'd let fly again. But at one stage of the proceedings, and this is where I'm wrong about time, you see, none of us had watches. We weren't rich enough to own watches. And Steve Ambrose mentions this in his book. Details tally, but the timing's all wrong. Some say 10 o'clock, half past 10, 11 o'clock. Not many of us owned watches on a quid a week. We weren't like some rich Americans, all had a watch each. But at one stage, there was firing coming from the top of the water tower. Now, there's still a water tower there on the right. I'm not talking about that one. This was on the left bank. And there was firing. And when we looked at it close, there was two fellas lying on top. Gave Major out a shout. Now, we were having trouble with the minis, the moaning minis. They were dropping all around. So, well, it's... I think his words were, "What do you make? Or what do you make of it?" I said, "Well, the sniping, I think they might be OPs for the minis." He said, "Get them off there." I put three shells through the water tower. I put the entire waterworks out of action, and they disappeared completely off the back of the water tower. So if ever you're in Hamburg, you'll see two elderly grey-eyed gentlemen walking around, jerking and jumping and suffering from shell shock. It's probably those two. Now, later on that day, apart from other firing in various places, there was some firing coming from somewhere, and the bullets were going through. By the time D-Day was over, that rotating cover, corrugated tin, was absolutely riddled with bullet holes. And then somebody spotted it, the chateau down on the canal bank. Not the window on the left, which lays back, but the next window, one along from that, and another one too long. You could see the sparkle of machine gun fire. That's where the bastards were. I didn't swing the gun round directly. I just eased it round, and one up the spout, two more ready. And in quick succession, I put three shells through the top windows of the chateau. And that quietened it. But as I did so, there was a terrible roar from at the back. And I turned around, and there was Major Howard. Well, I'm not going to describe what he called me or what he said. But one of the last instructions we were given was not to fire at the chateau. It was the local maternity home. I'd completely forgotten it. Well, I thought he was going to shoot me, quite frankly, but he calmed down a bit. To this day, he's still never forgiven me for putting those three shells through the top of the maternity home. But Steve Ambrose said, well, sirs, Mark, they shouldn't have been there in the first place. The only able-bodied men in the district were Germans. So there you go. But later on that afternoon, I was just taking a quiet cigarette. And I was turned sideways in the seat. It was a swivel seat. And all of a sudden, one of the fellas said, for Christ's sake, look. And as I sort of looked up and looked round, John Howard had apparently come out for a breather and shouted, Pa, don't let that bloody boat get near this damn bridge. And I looked, and coming up from Caen, right in the middle of the bloody canal, was a boat heavily laden with German soldiers. I just couldn't believe it. And there was a bow wave in front of it. Right, I've got one up the spout. I've got the elevating handle. I've got the traverse. I'm doing the lot. And, of course, the boat is not a standing target. I must point out that over on the right-hand side of the gun pit was a range chart in metres, all written in German. And it gave the range to a clump of trees on the right, a larger clump on the left, to the chateau, and to the curve in the river. So all I had to do to get between them is just calculate the difference between this and that, alter the range, and I've got anything under control. But this thing was a moving target. And I'm looking at it through the sight. It was a sort of telescopic sight. And it's getting closer, and I started to shout, well, somebody give me a range on the damn thing. And I'm still keeping it in focus, but obviously the range is decreasing as it's belting towards us. And then somebody shouted out about 800, 750, it's got to be 725. I've adjusted it and fired the first one. And a terrific plume of water went up about 20 yards in front of the boat, as near as I can estimate, 20 to 30. I was about 30 yards short. I've never seen a boat do a U-turn so quick. It turned across from right to left as I'm looking at it, but this time the next one's up and I hit it broadside on, just about where the railings met the woodwork, and it shuddered literally. But this time it had managed to turn, and before it disappeared around the bend of the Caen Canal, I managed to put three out of four shots up his backside. And it was limping up the canal with smoke pouring out of it. And the gang over in there, including some captured Germans and one thing and another, were all cheering their heads off. They thought it was great fun. I did, as a matter of fact. I must admit here at this point, on a personal note, since the initial bombing of various places in England in 1914, and then seeing London, Bristol and other places bombed to smithereens, it gave me the greatest personal delight on D-Day to sit behind a German captured gun firing German ammunition up German arseholes. I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. One of the other things that sticks in my mind on that particular day was just after dawn, John Howard said, get the strips out. These were fluorescent strips. They were in a very bright greeny-yellow colour and a sort of chaparral-y pink. And we weighed them down with weights all across the bridge. Certain fighter commands had been given orders at no under no circumstances are tanks allowed to get near the bridges over the canal and the river Orne. It obviously wasn't called Pegasus Bridge in those days, that was not too long afterwards. And just after dawn, sweeping out of the sky, came the first of the fighters. And it was a most emotional experience. They turned in the sky over there, and they came down and peeled off. And as they came over the bridge, and they couldn't have been more than 200 or 300 feet above us, each one did a victory roll. They were there watching us.
These were Spitfires,
weren't they? Yeah, Spitfires. These were later followed by Hurricanes, but they kept up a non-stop patrol over those two bridges all day. There was only one time they came unstuck. In the film The Longest Day, it shows you two fighters going along the beaches, but there was one other fighter. I will stand corrected. I think it was a fighter bomber, possibly a Dornier, I'm not sure. Now, I did not see this plane. I was in there. But I heard this thing coming in, and it was low. And the next thing I heard was shouting, yelling, and a banging, and that was it. I took no more notice until 15 minutes later, approximately, somebody came in and said, "We're bleeding lucky to be alive." It was a German fighter bomber that had come out of the sun, hedgehopping, with one damn great bomb slung underneath it and one job to destroy the bridge. He let go his bomb. The fellas looking up, and Ted Tappanen and John Howard watched it, knew that they were dead. It came straight at them. Some had time to throw themselves on the ground, not that it would have done any good. And the bomb, in actual fact, hit the superstructure of the bridge, but not bang on. It glanced on the side of it. The mark is still there today, followed by the fin marks. It bounced off it, the canal bank, and went into the canal without exploding. And that was the biggest luck of all that we ever had on D-Day. One bomb, and he was spot on target, except for maybe a foot. If you'd have hit that superstructure head on, now we're looking towards Khan now, that's the way it came, he would have blown the whole damn lot to pieces and everything with it. It was a big bomb. The mark is still there. I don't know how they do it, but when you go over there these days, it's a cantilever bridge and it swings up and down. But when you look up there sometimes now, of a D-Day or any other time you're there, you'll see the birds nesting in the hole. How they manage to keep the eggs in the nest when it's going up and down, I should never know. But believe me, they still nested in there. That was one of our biggest strokes of luck. There were a great many other incidents that day. One of them was my old mate, who you just referred to, Bill. His name is Jack Bailey, known as Bill Bailey. He was a great lover for a cup of tea, Bill Bailey, or char, as he used to call it, and he couldn't go long without his char. And at about 11 o'clock approximately, fighting away in Benneville, he suddenly decided it was time for his cup of tea. I can only describe him as a sort of cockney, you know, old coward, everything stops for tea. So he decided to abandon the battle for the time being and couldn't find a quiet place. So he came marching down from Benneville, came to the gun pit, walked in, looked at me, he said, "This looks nice and quiet underneath here, I'm going to brew up." Well, a tummy cook would take 20 minutes to brew up. He went down there and I fired a shell and all the sand and muck fell on top of him and he came up. He's a big raw bone fella. Lovely fella, but oh. And he just looked at me, he said, "Pa," he said, "don't fire that bleeding gun again, will you? So I've had my cup of tea, there's all shit falling on top of me." I said, "Yeah, all right. So the war stopped for about 15 minutes, as far as the gun was concerned. But they were creeping up and creeping up and creeping up. And somebody said, and it was over on the right-hand bank. There was a space between some bushes and another clump. And one shot across. Now there was already two there, we know, so that made four, and then two more come scurrying across, because the gun was quiet and it was doing alright, and there were six of them, and I swung the gun round. I've got six of them behind this clump of bushes. I suppose it was a 10-yard clump, give or take a power. And I just aimed the gun and I fired. And the next thing you know, there was a terrible scream from somewhere outside, and I thought, some poor bastard's got it. And, believe it or not, I saw two hands, big hands, holding the inside of what's there, and there was Bailey.
Inside of the what?
Just holding, pulling himself up the two steps inside the gun pit. It was Bailey. His face was livid. his cup of char had just come to the boil. He'd put his powdered milk and his sugar in it, and I fired the bleeding gun, and the whole of the roof fell in on top of it and turned it into mud. Bailey came into there, and I left my post, and I ran round the front end of the gun. He chased me round there. I ran round the other side, and I think I was in more danger from Bill Bailey that day on that bridge than there were so many bloody Germans. He eventually gave up the chase, and he went off swearing and cursing without his cup of tea. Bailey's had many a cup of tea in my house since then. Many a cup. And whenever he used to come up here, I'd say, do you want a beer, Bailey? No, you know what I want, really. And she'd go out and make him a bloody great mug of Sergeant Majors. Good, strong stuff. And he'd get through three or four in the course of an evening. And to this day, he did tell this story for the D-Day anniversary tape on ITN. He told the story of the cup of tea. And you know, when I've watched him do it on the video there, and his eyes go like that, you know. And I don't think like John Alford, Shelley in the Chateau, Bailey's never quite forgiven me for that cup of tea that he needed so most. The day wore on, and at approximately 1 o'clock, gotta be approximate about it, John Howard started shouting, quiet, quiet, everybody, the bloody hell's happening now. Turn round, and John says, quiet, and then we could hear it, a bugle in the distance. This was answered by a hunting horn over on our right towards Ronville. He said, that's it, boys, the commandos are coming. Well, I know it sounds like Custer's Last Stand or something out of some third-rate American film, but any of those survivors would tell you that. The commandos were coming. They were sounding the bugle. We went potty. We fired everything we could. We were cheering and shouting and shooting like mad. About a half an hour later, the bugle sounded again, but this time it was at the village of Benneville, just up past the crossroads. A few minutes after that, give it 10 minutes, somebody shouted, come and look at this lot. And I dashed out of the gun pit onto this side of the bridge where the gliders had landed, and I looked up the road. And coming down the road from the T-junction was the unmistakable figure of Lord Lovett. He has denied wearing it since. He criticised the film, The Longest Day, but I can assure you he was wearing a roll neck, white or cream pullover, a green beret. And he had a pack on his back, which I didn't see at that time. To his right, slightly three paces in front of him, was Bill Millen. Bill Millen was not wearing a kilt. Bill Millen was wearing a battle dress, playing the bagpipes. On either side, in single file, were his commandos. Some had green berets, some helmets, some equipment, some no equipment. They were all carrying a weapon of some sort. And behind them, in the middle of the road, they were given a squadron of tanks to escort them from the beaches to the bridges. It was one Cromwell tank, one. And they came down. I was rather overcome by the sight, and I just ran across the bridge. Lovett had just passed the Café Gondry. He was a taller man than me, and I stopped short, about 6 foot short of him. He just held up his hand and stopped, and I suddenly thought, well, what the hell am I doing here? And I just stood there and I saluted him. He saluted back very much like that. And Bill Millen had rested his bagpipes and was looking at me. And I said, we're very pleased to see you, sir. And all Lovett said was, well done, well done. And then he said to me, where is your company command post? I said, you want Major Howard, sir? I said, it's in the pillbox over there. And I turned back, and as I turned back, Monsieur Gondry, the cafe owner, George Gondry, came running out of the cafe. He had 2 bottles of champagne, about 3 glasses. No, I beg your pardon, I'll get this right. He had 1 bottle of champagne and 3 glasses, and he was shouting and laughing and crying in French all at the same time. Lord Lovett turned half right, spoke to me in French and said, "Non, non." Georges Gondry stopped. Now, Bill Millen was a very hot, tired, thirsty, dusty Scotsman. And me and him was both looking at the champagne. And Lord Lovett just raised his hand and went like that.
Put and his hand went. Down.
No, he just lifted his hand up there and went forward. A bump. And they went across. By this time I've been joined, I think it was by Billy Gray and Charlie Gardner, and Monsieur Gondry opened the champagne and I lifted it and Bill Millen looked back. The commando's language was anything to be desired as we stood there just toasting them with champagne, courtesy of Monsieur Georges Gondry. Sounds a tall story, except for one thing. Bill Millen now lives down in Dawlish in Devon. And for the 40th anniversary, he had a big picture done. A very big picture done. He sent me one in a folder, and on the bottom of it, it's got Dwolly Power and the Perils of Pegasus Bridge. I still regret that glass of champagne I never had when we met on Pegasus Bridge, 6th of June 1944. My kindest regards to your dear wife, Piper Bill Millen, No. 1 Special Commando Brigade. And that particular poster was up there until 6 months ago.
On your wall?
Up there. Until I gave it to an American who runs the Indiana Military Museum. After that, they came pouring in. I got back to the gun pit. The tank took up a position just by the cafe, and we covered the commandos. They were very lackadaisical going across in the beginning, and then they learned. I was giving them covering fire. They were bringing guns, and then they had to run. They lost 11 commandos crossing the bridge that afternoon, killed by snipers. We did our best to keep them down, but you couldn't keep them all down. And by this time, the machine guns were also moving up. It was a fantastic day. The title for the film, The Longest Day, came, strangely enough, from a fellow by the name of Billy Gray, who now lives in Northampton. After we got back, there was this war correspondent came down. He was collecting stories. He was official historian, that's it, army historian. And he came eventually to D Company to find out about the story of Pegasus Bridge, and of course John Howard gave him an interview, and John Howard wanted two men dressed in fighting gear, rifles, bayonets, and of course he picked a Billy Gray, big, strong East Ender, and of course we were taking the mick out of them, going to have their photographs taken and one thing and another, and I think the other one was Rocky Bright. He was a big tall fella. They eventually went up to the company office. John Howe finished his interview, and this historian called them in. Asked for their stories, and one thing or another, they told it. And when Billy Gray finished his story, this fellow said, "Have you anything further to add?" And Billy just stood there and said, "Well, no," he said, "except that on Pegasus Bridge on D-Day, that was the longest day of my life." And the fellow looked at him and he said, well, it's the longest day of my life. And the fellow said, "When I write the book, that's the name of it, it was Cornelius Rhyne. The Longest Day." And the title came from Billy Gray, who now lives in Northampton. The day wore on, as days do. The wounded were counted, and two dead, one glider missing. 22 platoon, Lieutenant Hoover, Captain Brian Pridey, second in command, had landed on a bridge over the River Deves, 10 miles away. This was due to a navigational error by the navigator in the tug plane. They never did see Pegasus Bridge. They eventually made their way overland through occupied country and got to Ronville at 9 o'clock on the night of D-Day. They lost, I believe it was 5 or 6 men. One of the first men to be killed there was Hemi Hedges. As they tried to get across this bridge, he was cut down by machine gun fire. That is the story of what is known as the longest day. From my point of view, But I'm sure any of the few survivors at a quarter mile force of 180 men from D Company, B Company of the Oxen Bucks, 30 Royal Engineers and 12 glider pilots, plus our wonderful medical officer, Jacobs, Captain Jacobs, later Captain Vaughan, who still now lives down in Devon. That was our story. At the present moment, we can muster something like 20 survivors. From my own personal point of view, I'm very pleased that I was there, and also very proud. Thank
you. Now let me move on further on into your war career to the Ardennes, and can you tell me how you were involved with that? Was that the German counter-offensive in the Ardennes?
Yes, in actual fact, what happened, we were getting ready for Christmas in Bulford. We'd already got mistletoe and holly in the barrack rooms, the dining hall and one thing or another. And the Battle of Bulge was going on somewhere down in the Ardennes. We knew that we were not going to be involved in that. We were back here in this country. We were still being brought up to strength from the Normandy campaign. And then at something like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the day before Christmas Eve, the lights went on and the order was, get yourselves together, get dressed, we're on the move. I'd already made arrangements to meet my wife Irene in Corsham, 35 miles away. I'd been home the weekend previous for a simple procedure of slipping out of barracks and hitchhiking down. I said, I'll be home for Christmas dinner, don't worry, love. 10,000 men of the 6th Airborne Division were paraded in their various barracks. We were put into trucks and taken down to Dover, we were, where the rest went, I'm not sure. We were carted across the Channel and arrived there Christmas Eve, and we were taken slightly inland and we were put up in various villages. I finished up with a fellow called Andrews and again my old mate Charlie Gardner in a chateau where they seemed to have hundreds of chickens everywhere, and we were given a wonderful reception by the local inhabitants. And
do you know the name of the chateau?
Oh no, I wouldn't know. I'd describe it as a chateau. I'd say it was a very, very large mansion type place. I've never been back there since, but I know you had to cross a moat to get into it. It was surrounded by a moat, and they lugged out a frying pan the size of which I've never seen before, and they put 30 eggs in there. We counted them as they put them in, and we had 10 eggs each fried. I thought they were starving. These people weren't starving. I'd never seen anything like it. Oh, and strips of bacon. We then went out and had a drink in the local estaminet, call it what you will. Came back, we went to bed in silk sheets and a bed. Charlie and I shared a bed that must have been 8 foot across by 10 foot. Tommy Andrews, that's the other fella, Tommy Andrews, he had a room to himself somewhere. We got up in the morning and had more breakfast. They gave us black cheroots, small cigar type things. We got into trucks at 10 o'clock, approximately on Christmas morning. All the village waved us goodbye, and we started off in these three-ton trucks. We travelled for 22 hours through roads that became worse and worse and more frost. We did stop at one village, and all the locals turned out, and they had those old-fashioned urinals, I believe they're called, you know, where you can see your feet underneath and from your chest upwards. And we were breaking our necks, and we all dived into one of these, and there was the entire village, a small town, surrounding us, and they were all dressed in rabbit skin coats, rabbit skin hats at first. And there we are, having a slash with one hand and kissing them and shaking hands with the other hand. It was the most hilarious scene. But they never gave us any food. They were short of food. We got back in the trucks again, and about an hour or so out of that place, we stopped for Christmas dinner. I was 25 platoon. Lowered the